This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Glad you're joining us today. My name is Markus Kipp, and I'll be hosting this episode. Chile despertó, Chile woke up, is a key slogan of the ongoing uprisings in Chile that began in the capital, Santiago, in October 2019. Since then, heavy confrontations happened with the regime of President Piñera, deploying the army and installing curfews in an attempt to quell the unrest. Although the protests have disappeared from the title pages of most international media outlets by now, the protests are ongoing and a new wave of protests is lying in wait. Over the past 4 months, human rights organizations have counted 35 people dying in the context of these protests and more than 400 people severely wounded. Chile is counted among one of the most unequal countries in Latin America and has a remarkable history of political contestation. In this episode, I have the chance to talk to Asun Candina, a historian, and Daniel Opaso, an architect, both living in Santiago and working there at the Universidad de Chile. Asun and Daniel describe the movement for us, focus on the urban dimension of the uprising, and point to its historical trajectory. To begin with, Daniel, I would be interested to hear how this current round of protests came into being in October.
Well, back in October, the uprising began, at least in the view of the media, with a protest mainly from high school and university students about a race in the metro ticket, in the subway, you know, the subway fare. However, and this is a phrase that caught many people's attention, and it's pretty, you know, it goes to the point, I think. Quickly, it spread around saying, the saying was that it's not 30 pesos, which was the amount of the race in the subway fare. It's not 30 pesos, it's 30 years, you know, alluding to the period between 1990 and the present, you know, the democracy after the dictatorship, and how neoliberal policies had basically, you know, shaped contemporary Chilean society, and how now people were reacting to that because of the accumulation over the years of, stress on the working class. So in a way, all the demands which were, in a way, disconnected, now, people began focusing on changing the system. After 30 years, many people realized it was about the system as a whole.
A lot of people, especially the political class and some of the upper classes in Chile, say, well, this was a big surprise. We didn't see it coming. No lo vimos venir. It's the phrase in Spanish. We didn't see it coming. This is a complete surprise. And this is a mobilization of young people. It's a chaotic situation. There's no leadership. We don't know what's going to happen in this country now. And I don't really think it's that way, because as historian and as historian of the recent history of Latin America and Chile, we can see that in this century, especially from the year 2004 and 2005, we have various and several mobilizations, as Daniel put it, claro. The secondary or high school students, the university students, all the social movements, especially the feminist movement, was a very big year last year and in 2018. So we can see that this mobilization now from October to now, it's part of a very long change of recent mobilizations. And they have a very, I would say, complex and deep reflection and critical reflection about our recent history in the past 30 or 40 years, starting with the socialist government of the Unidad Popular with Salvador Allende, the coup d'etat, and after that, the dictatorship of Pinochet, and a very critical view of the governments of the Concertación o Partidos por la Democracia, meaning the transitional process in Chile. So that vision that this happened one day to the other, that was the very big riot, a national riot, especially in the cities, I think it's not true. I think it's a way to try to present it like a very, I don't know, dangerous phenomena who has nothing to do with the majority of the people in this country, and it's not. If you go further of the TV or the cable of some people in the social nets, and you go to the streets in Chile, and you go to the asambleas and cabildos, who are kind of democracy meetings from the people in the neighborhoods. You were asking about the cities. I think this has been the continuum, for using the Latin word, a continuum of a social movement that has been in the streets, has been in the streets artistically and politically for a very long time now.
Chile woke up, so elaborate a little bit for me on this. It's basically saying that the population finally woke up after 30 years of oppression.
Basically, I would say that the waking up has more to do with, there was another saying, which it's a little long, but I will try to translate it to you, because I think it supplements this idea of Chile waking up. Someone wrote in some wall, said, before we were fine, but it was a lie. Now we are not fine, but it's okay, because now it's true. You know? So this normality basically was shattered by the people realizing that, you know, this system is basically screwing us all. So this waking up, it's a very subtle oppression. It's like, I think, I'm not a sociologist, but I would say that it's like a Foucauldian textbook phenomenon, in the way that, you know, you're not like every day being beaten up by the police in the streets, which has happened in a daily basis these last 4 months. But it was a slow and subtle oppression by means of, you know, you being a small piece of a very complex and you know, relentless system. You know, like we were in a way hypnotized by consumption and credit cards and new and, you know, ever renovating shopping malls and, yeah, you know, gated neighborhoods and stuff and so on and so forth, and even consumerism had, you know, even go deep in lower classes. I mean, many people in Chile are indebted in 3 times their monthly salary.
Yeah, you know? Because when you think how low are the salaries in Chile, the people have to go there. The people have to go to the banks, have to go to the credit cards. And yeah, I agree that the thing is, it's not that the Chilean people were so happy with the system. And one day, out of the blue, we discovered that we were not happy at all. I think that for a very long time, there was a major quota of resignation in this country. That's the way it is. Mm. It's not much what we have, what we can do or what we could do about it. That was changing in the last decade. And I think this October social uprising, mm-hmm, we were thinking about the translation of, yeah, estallido social. We think a social uprising is good. It's, yes, a good translation of that. In October of the last year, was an accumulation. And I want to emphasize that it was an accumulation of experiences too, of experiences of exploitation, yeah, of repression. But with that, with the experiences of organization, of discussion, of reflection of many groups in the Chilean society. I'm not saying that the majority of Chilean people, it's part of these groups, but I'm saying this collective leadership of different groups, student, feminist, working class,
neighborhood organizations,
neighborhood leadership, yeah, too, trade union leaders too, I've been the organizers of this in the good way, not in the way that Sebastián Piñera is saying that there's a kind of a secret, very well-organized, highly organized enemy. Which is kind of crazy, but I can understand what he is trying to look for that enemy somewhere. There, he's trying to look for somebody, a specific person or group to blame for a social uprising, which is general.
Actually, I think within this context of Chile waking up, the you know, violent policies of the government have been a major factor in making more and more people aware of the need to protest, to change the system. So they deployed military in the streets, and that didn't happen or hadn't happened in 30 something years. I mean, since the dictatorship, they hadn't
since
been
1984. Yeah, there wasn't,
there hadn't been a curfew in over 30 years, and this president had the bad idea of of signing a decree to install the curfew. And during the curfew, which lasted like for 10 days or so, 15 days maybe?
Yeah, more than a week.
There were huge riots. I mean, people burning. And this is important, I think, for your interest. People burning down pharmacies, supermarkets, other retail stores. I mean, the symbol of the system became the retail, branches. And there were many fires. So there was a moment which was very sad, because there were some people dead in the first days of the first weeks of the uprising. And in Congress, some representatives from the center left, they showed the portraits of the people who have died, and the right wing representatives showed pictures of the supermarkets that had been burned. So that was the rationale of both groups, and the right wing in the government, they were crying and weeping about the supermarkets. And so that, angered people a lot.
Because what happened in the streets in terms of art, of graffiti or street art, and part of the demonstration, the manifestations, all the performances, for some people is just delinquency and vandalism. And for the other people, it's a way to expression and it's a way of art. There is an initiative in Instagram called Museo de la Dignidad, Dignity Museum, hundreds and now thousands of people collaborating, taking pictures of all the arts in the streets, and they are putting in Instagram in a more organized way, trying to improve the images and everything, and trying to get a recording of all that's happening and how our cities are changing. And it's very interesting too, all that happened with the monuments and the streets, because it's not just destruction. It has been destruction. It has been things that are all in the floor, destroyed. But there is a lot of monuments, for example, of the Spanish conquerors in the colonial period. Those statues have been dragged to the statues of the symbols of the originary people, and put it there as an offer, just a token, if you would say that, of the change. We need justice. And this is a very old fight for us. And that happened with the statues too. The statues of General Baquedano, which is in the ex-Plaza Italia, now Plaza de la Dignidad, the Dignity Square, has not been destroyed. But it's completely painted and changed as a Mapuche, an indigenous people, and another one.
Most media coverage has been centered around what Asun said is now called Dignity Square, which is a point in the city which traditionally marked the division between east and west, between the affluent neighborhoods and the rest of the city, right? And now that place, in that's where, you know, people gathered when Chile had a sport success eventually. But now,
once in a blue moon,
the meaning, the signification of that place completely changed into a place of political symbolism and of, you know, this new spirit of more just society. So people gather there, do some artistic manifestations, but also resist the police. There's a group of young people who have taken to resist the police, like one block away from this square, in order to allow people to manifest. And those are called the first line. And that's what has attracted most of the media coverage. But in the first weeks, in the first month of the uprising, and there were some, as we told you, some fires, some, you know, arson episodes. But those were also in downtown, but mostly I would say in the surroundings of in more peripheral neighborhoods. There were some neighborhoods which, you know, where now there are no pharmacies working or no supermarkets. So many people, I mean, at least me, I'm part of them. We you know, are suspicious of those fires, because when the curfew ended, there were no more fires. We had supposedly people in their homes, because no one could leave home after 10 p.m. And we had the police and the military in the streets. But mysteriously, there were fires all over the city.
Yeah.
And then when the curfew ended,
supposedly provoked by the protesters.
Exactly.
About the bad people who were not home.
Yeah, the radical anarchist vandals or something like that.
Yeah.
But then, so you had some destruction around the city, which, as I said, ended with the curfew, but, you know, seriously affected some neighborhoods in terms of, you know, the possibility of acquiring food and, you know, medicine and stuff. But also around the city, not so much in downtown, people began to gather in squares, in you know, community parks, as Asun said, in order to organize cabildos, which are, you know, assemblies. And in those places, people began talking about, well, how to change the system and ultimately how to change, or why to change, our constitution, which in a way has been the most you know, visible result of the protest process, because now we're engaged in a sort of institutional process which would lead to a referendum in April in order to approve or reject the possibility of writing a new constitution. But in terms of the urban scale, it's interesting that the most, you know, the you know, the higher violence has been concentrated in Dignity Square, but around the city, people have begun organizing at the neighborhood scale.
What would you say are these issues that link all these different actors together? Is this the issue of demanding or creating a new constitution?
I would like to quote one of the models of the lemmas of this mobilization: hasta que la dignidad se haga costumbre, until dignity becomes usual. And I think it's a very good way to see it. This is not a revolutionary movement. There is no group trying to take power here or trying to install some sort of revolution of the 20th century. There is people trying to live with more dignity, trying to, the upper classes, and especially the richest one, that 0.001% of the population who owns more than 30 or 40% of the wealth in Chile, just I don't know, give up just a little bit. So we don't have people dying that are waiting for medical attention in public hospitals. So we have kids that are not dying in the public system for abused children. So we don't have the very high rates of domestic violence and violence against women. So that's what we want. And part of this, as you said, it's a new constitution, a new legal frame that allow us to do some of the change that we need, which are just democratic change and exist in almost all the countries in the world, including the capitalistic countries or the capitalist countries.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on this urban dimension as you see it? I mean, not to forget that the issue of the transport prices, of course, is something that relates to a very crucial part of the infrastructure, no?
Because, I mean, in this city, in Santiago, you have a way of living where many people have to travel 90 minutes or more from their homes to working places. So when they return home at night, they basically, you know, kiss goodnight their children, and that would be it. I mean, they eat and they go to sleep, and the other day they wake up at 6 a.m. in order to get to their work on time. So transportation has been a huge subject because of its poor quality.
Social inequality.
Yes.
It's a very good example of social inequality.
Then you have also some neighborhoods. I mean, the city expanded from the 80s on, in horizontally, without any, you know, planning provisions.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, planning was destroyed in Chile and in most Latin American countries during the 80s under militarist dictatorships, and particularly both economic planning and urban planning. So you have many neighborhoods, I mean, those where people have to travel 90 minutes or more, sometimes it's over 2 hours, and those places don't have adequate services in terms of health, childcare, education, shopping in terms of acquiring medicines, and et cetera, et cetera. The experience of inequality is on a daily basis. You know, you can see it when you live in a poor neighborhood. You don't have trees on the streets. You don't have a nice square with a playground for children. While in affluent neighborhoods, those are things at hand, and sometimes people don't even use the squares because they have private gardens and private lawns, and where their children can play. I mean, this sounds a little bit, you know, melodramatic, but it's not that far from reality.
So is it mostly those suburbs, those neighborhoods in the outskirts that have risen up, that have engaged in this movement? Is this the areas where the discontent is most clearly articulated?
No. No, because this is not just affect the poor people, this affect the middle classes too. This affect the people from poor neighborhoods, but affect people in the suburbs too. They affect people of the middle class, I mean teachers, clerics too, who has to live in a very distant neighborhood because they can't pay the prices. This is the movement of the majority of the people, including middle classes, and lower classes and popular groups, against a very, very small group of people who's at the peak of his power in economic and political power.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, as we said before, the protest had been, you know, organized in city downtown. You know, it's not like uprisings in the peripheral, in the suburb, in the border or external outer neighborhoods, but it is the people who manifest in several places. People have also manifested in their local, you know, environment, taking to the you know, the main square of a given neighborhood, but most protesting have concentrated in downtown. I mean, in Dignity Square, there have been protests of a million people.
To what extent do the protesters in Chile gain some sort of inspiration from other protests that are currently ongoing in the world? Hong Kong being one example that we've already covered in one of our episodes. Can you give us some ideas?
I would say, not saying that there's no relationship at all, but I think people protesting are drawing more inspiration from the former Chilean movements of this century, as Asun also said. The high school students in 2006, the university students in 2011, the feminist movement in 2018. So those are like, you know, layers or you know, yes, geological foundations of this movement.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, yeah.
Strata, geological strata of this movement.
Yeah, the government is trying to put to us that all this mobilization has to do with foreign elements, with kids who, I don't know, watch too much TV or spend too much time in the internet. Trying to put it or show this movie like a childish movement, and they usually
led by Venezuela.
Oh yes, or led by Venezuela, or another crazy idea like the K-pop in South Korea or things like that. We are all having fun with that kinds of declarations, but no, this is a serious movement. And we have our own developments about it.
Great. I'd like to hear what you see as the movement's achievements so far, like speaking from the time since October. What has been achieved?
I think three things. This plan or this idea of Sebastián Piñera becoming an international leadership, an international leader, to have a leadership showing Chile as an oasis in Latin America was questioned deeply and probably destroyed. The questioning of the neoliberal system too. This, as I said before, this is not the traditional leftist revolution who wants to take the power like I don't know, the Soviet Revolution, not at all. People who said that, it's really out of their minds. Sorry if I say it like that. But yeah, it's a questioning of the neoliberal movement. It's a questioning about that, how this neoliberal system of movement humiliates a lot of people. That's the first one. The second one, I said that we're starting a process to have a new constitution, a new legal framework that allow us to do some changes. And the third thing for me is just my personal opinion that, as Daniel said before, there is a lot of people who are working in this group or this organization and the other, sometimes with not much contact between each other. And this large mobilization, these encounters in the streets, in the squares, sometimes confronting repression, and sometimes dancing and talking and debating with each other, I think it's a very good thing for Chilean society, and I hope it makes us a more compassionate and people with more solidarity, who really sees what's happening with the other. In all these years of neoliberalism as a system, I think the time that you just think, okay, I have to go by myself. I have to, I don't know, get a credit card and just take care of my own life. This principle has been questioning deeply in this society. For me, that's the three more, the main things or the three more important things about this movement.
Sure. I feel totally represented by that. Yeah, couldn't say it better.
So given the enormous price that has been already paid and the enormous amount of energy that has already been spent since October, how do you think this movement can keep up the energy to push its goals?
Well, I guess now many people say that, you know, the movement is, you know, gathering strength for March, because the referendum is in April, so it's very likely that the whole from March 1 until April 26th, yeah, when the referendum will be held, there will be protests all over Chile, because I mean we have the movement has had some, you know, gains like the constitutional process. But all the demands referring to the daily life have not been met or answered by the government. I mean, the minimum wage is still the same. The pension fund system has not been touched. There haven't been any announcement about investment in public education or public health,
yeah,
or anything.
His campaign, the campaign against the change of the constitution.
Yes, so it's very likely that the social tension will be there, and we will have a very shaken city and year, at least until October.
Probably,
because,
yes.
Because if in April we win the referendum and the idea of a new constitution is approved, The Constitutional Assembly will be elected in October, so you will probably have protests all the year. It's true.
Yeah, we historians, we are very bad predicting the future.
Hmm? Yeah.
I mean, bad.
I think they're worse.
but yeah, looking at the present moment as a citizen, not as a historian, yes, this movement is still going. It's ongoing, and it has to be a very important moment in March, in April, with this first votation, and then the rest of the year. I don't know, of course, nobody knows, but I have that impression.
Yeah, March the 8th will be the first huge protest for the International Day of Working Class Women.
Yes.
Okay, Asun and Danielle, thank you very much. We'll be watching closely throughout the next couple of months, and I wish you best of luck, and thank you very much for sharing your insights.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.